Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back as my guest, David Lowe. We've had several interviews with David. You can check them out at www.plastikos.com under Resources and Radio. But today we're going to be discussing monster religions. Monster religions are religions that are all over the planet, and we'll talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Susan. It's wonderful to be here. It'll be a good topic for sure.
So, can you define monster religions? Which ones are the monsters and which ones don't quite make it?
Well, the monsters are Judaism is sort of a little monster. The real monsters are Christianity and Islam. The others don't make it because they don't have the propensity to go all over the earth and to think that they're better than anybody else. Those are the monsters, and there are some definite things to discuss. The problematic things that I'd like to see us talk about don't apply to 4 out of 5 Jews and Christians, and don't apply to 3 out of 5 Muslims. The Muslim world being less educated overall, but for some folks, I think it'll be good to hear this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important to educate people about religion, because what we see on the news sometimes isn't quite representative of the religion, especially with the Islam faith and what is being, I guess, presented to the predominantly Christian country here. It's almost like there's a war of ideas going on.
Yeah, what you have is religions historically on the political dimension, the politics has to be understood by everybody, including small children or adults who think like children. So as a result, the fundamentalist, literal interpretation of scriptures always holds at the political level. It's one of those things which can only be overcome gradually through more education. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what is fundamentalism, because I don't think everybody understands, you know, they've heard the term, but the fundamentalism is the interpretation, very strict interpretation of a religious text. Is that
right?
Is that
it's
correct?
Basically, word for word interpretation according to the way the words are most commonly defined. Most people with any degree of education fall within what I call the metaphorical / allegorical partial interpretation, some literal, some metaphorical, allegorical. But fundamentalist religion is basically corresponds to literalist interpretation, in which the words are understood in the normal, straightforward way that we think of them and are not interpreted metaphorically or allegorically. Yeah.
Dr. Michael Rice has done a lot of work in translating the original Aramaic directly into English for parts of the Bible. You may have seen some of his work, the Beatitudes. When you do that, the meaning is so different that we begin to realize that what Jesus was actually teaching is really quite different than what's in the Bible today. And it can be understood as multiple translations, you know, from the Aramaic to the Latin to the Greek, or I think it might be to the Greek, then the Latin, and then English.
Right.
But multiple translations. Michael Rice says that the ancient Aramaic, which Jesus taught in, was a very precise language of physics, and that we don't have the English terms for it. And that's why when the translation comes through, there's a whole bunch more words in English than there was in the Aramaic. I mean, because you have to explain a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah,
but then when
general,
you realize what he was teaching was totally different than what the Bible says.
Right. I think probably the most general thing for people to understand is that for scholars who study religion objectively, and actually also for a great number of Christian and mainline Protestant scholars, it's generally agreed that much of the Gospels were basically embellished for the sake of mass appeal. They were trying to create a religion, after all. If you ask, you know, charismatic or fundamentalist scholars, if you want to call them that, then they say no, it's all literally true. But there was a definite editing process which went into what they decide to portray as a primary understanding of the faith. And it's very different.
Yeah, I have an interesting story. I got stuck on an airplane for 3 hours because there was mechanical problems, and sitting next to me was the number one expert in the Southern Baptist religion. He was a PhD. He'd been to the Vatican. He'd studied all of the religious text that, you know, you and I can't get to.
Right.
And when he figured out that I could channel answers, because I can, he asked me for hours and hours different questions, and then I would channel the answer. I would just hear it and then tell him. And do you know that he told me that he knew that reincarnation was true? He knew, I mean, everything that, say, you know, the spiritually based people that understand things, I would say the initiates mainly.
Sure.
He knew all of that. I mean, he knew all sorts of stuff. And this was the guy that went around to Southern Baptist and helped people interpret things. So I would say that the high part of the Catholic religion, the Southern Baptist religion, certainly the Mormon religion. There's no question that the Mormons know all sorts of things at the high levels.
Sure.
But they don't share it with the common churches.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an issue where, you know, the whole structure of Christianity being masculinely oriented would have to change significantly. And I really don't think, you know, you can't incorporate the feminine element of deity into Christianity without really almost evicting Jesus from the very core of it. You have to pair him off with somebody, or else I've often thought, you know, you could raise children monotheistically, but only if you were to either, I mean, on the level of the official theology and iconography, the pictures, as in children's pictures books, you'd either have to have separate deities or a deity which is androgynous, which occurs in, you know, the Eastern faiths all the time. That sounds like a very exceptional fundamentalist Southern Baptist. He should go tell everybody else.
Well, he explained his job as he was the main person that was the scholar, and then he would go around and help other people explain, you know, understand things in the Bible. And I was really very impressed with him. He knew a lot, and his questions were very good. And then at the end of it, when we actually we had to switch airplanes because they couldn't get it fixed, he asked me if he could call me again. He never did, but you know, he said that our conversation was fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, he had a couple hours just to ask whatever questions he wanted and get the answer from, you know, from source, which was, you know, what I do. So it's very interesting.
Let's hope that he influences other people in that denomination.
I think there are good people in every religion, and
absolutely,
I think that you would agree with that. You know,
absolutely.
It's just like anything, any institution, government, healthcare, the law, the legal profession. There's good and bad, and you can't just make judgments because they're in a certain religion or in a certain profession.
Yeah, I do think, though, I mean, you know, fundamentalist religion over the last decade and a half has really gotten out of hand. And there comes a time, I think, when you need to call a spade a spade. And it's really, you know, it's very difficult, but I think we need to recognize certain essential things about these faiths, which, you know, on the fundamentalist level are really problematic.
Can we talk about Christian fundamentalism first, and then we'll go to Islam? Okay, go ahead.
Well, I think they have a great deal in common. You know, psychophilosophically, there are some really issues with monotheism. Nothing is wrong with the one God, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is what people do unconsciously when they first learn about this one God. You know, we all
my God is better than your God.
right. I mean, we all hold profound ideals. Even the most practically minded and successful of us, part of us wants to escape the world. You know, we all hold these ideals deep down, and this one and only God way up there provides a psychological opportunity to do just that. You transcend the human condition, And doing that has some bad side effects. You dominate the earth from above, so it's inherently masculine. You think mm-hmm. you're superior to anything in nature, so it's inherently partitioning or destructive of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this carryover tendency to associate with sin anything earthly, anything, you know, like, you know, menstrual cycles, body fluids, sexuality, all that sort of thing is suddenly mm-hmm. kind of impure. And
right.
there's this carryover predisposition to regulate all those things when they shouldn't
mm-hmm.
be. So I think that's the really profound philosophical issue that I'd love to see people contemplate more, which gets
so,
that.
So how do you think Catholicism got the celibacy thing? Because I don't think that's found in other religions that much, is it?
Well, it's across the board monastically. Even there are small groups of Muslims and even some individual Jews who will practice celibacy intentionally, although they're mm-hmm. rare. Celibacy as a temporary practice is great, but problems come into play with the notion that it's
lifelong. Yeah.
Right. That.
Well, look
that
at all
like,
the sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. I mean,
exactly.
Good Lord, it doesn't work well
exactly.
to suppress that.
But you know, I think we do need to appreciate the, you know, more profound dimension of it. I mean, this is like the merging of the yin and the yang. The
mm-hmm.
universe makes love to itself all the time in ecstatic joy, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't get that. Most of us can't get that if we continue to behave like normal, ordinary humans. We have
mm-hmm.
to back off for a while, at least for a while, to get perspective on the deeper aspects of it. And then you can go back to it and enjoy it all you want. So, yeah, celibacy definitely, but on the Orthodox level, because it gets enforced under the idea, it ends up condemning the female body philosophically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It also reinforces the notion that, you know, that, well, sexuality is dirty, impure, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there is this transcendence above and beyond everything to great purity and etheric absolute joy and beauty, which is very misleading. Celibacy in Christianity especially has been very counterproductive to the faith overall.
And it's very interesting. There's some sources that say that Mary Magdalene, who was Jesus's wife, was
sure.
a pagan goddess. You know, she was trained in the goddess tradition, and she actually got permission from her goddess, which obviously isn't one god. You know, she was in a religion with multiple gods.
Right.
She got permission from her goddess that she was trained in the tradition of, and was able to marry Jesus and then have his children. So it's very interesting that Jesus chose a woman to be his life partner that was neither, you know, monotheistic or of his religion, Judaism. I mean,
right.
he married a shikska or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
It was funny. But, you know, that's a great example of, but they were both following their guidance, obviously. She
yeah.
had to have certain characteristics to even be his partner.
Right.
I mean, it was very important that she, well, they were both, I mean, he was a master. She was an initiate, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, he couldn't have really married anybody that wasn't an initiate, you know, or spiritually. It wouldn't have worked.
Sure. Yeah, I think anyone who is really established in the truth realizes that there is both this great, profound, all-embracing principle, which is totally impersonal, but that
mm-hmm.
great principle also has a profoundly personal dimension. And
right.
one of the great problems connected with these monster religions is you can't have any ceremonial reverence for nature. You know, at the
mm-hmm.
Orthodox level,
the pagans did, though. You see,
yeah,
paganism
right.
does. Yeah.
But at the Orthodox level, people need that kind of clarity. It's
mm-hmm.
God is good, the earth is bad, or at best, neutral.
Right.
And
yeah.
so, you know, you all these beautiful traditions around wood spirits and deities and you know, priestesses and so forth, you can't do that in these religions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess they think most of their followers are too dumb to get that they would get confused if you did both. I don't
mm-hmm.
think that's true. People would begin to understand that there can be both this great, all-embracing, transcendent principle, and at the same time, all these individual worship traditions which do celebrate the more feminine element of the whole thing.
Right.
But there
that's
tends
true.
To be this great domination and this notion that people would get confused and wouldn't understand if you had both at the same time. And I think people would get it.
Well, most of us here are familiar with, you know, the Christianity, you know, how the Peter founded the Catholic Church, and then
right.
that Martin Luther broke off, and Henry VIII broke off, and,
right.
you know, that, you know, the Mormons came in later with John Smith and everything. So that history is well known. I don't think they understand the history of Islam, though.
Right, right. Well, that's a very interesting situation. Judaism and Christianity both grew up under political authority, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were well accustomed to dealing with emperors and generals, and you had to be literate, you had to have good behavior and some
mm-hmm.
decorum to deal with your bosses, you know.
Right.
In ancient Arabia, there was none of that. Muhammad had a more difficult time civilizing the folks around him than any other religious leader
mm-hmm.
ever did. And that impacted the content of the Quran. The Quran ends up basically having to pander to a very, very savage level of ethics. These guys
right.
were not ready to love their enemies. So that
right.
influenced the content of the book in a very unfortunate way here and there. Yeah, that's the major
difference.
So that
might explain some of the misinterpretations.
Yeah, well,
you know, that you can, it's okay to kill anybody that's not Islam and that kind of thing.
Right. But I would devote a whole class to seven different sets of reasons why Islam tends to be associated with terrorism more so than the other faiths do.
Right.
The most profound reasons are, you know, a problematic language with in scripture, with scriptural sources. That's the biggest, most underlying and politically difficult one to talk about. Next to that is its tradition of political rule. You know, Christianity and Judaism had either very little or no success at all with actual, you know, rule over huge states and nations. The great emperors, the Roman emperors and the emperors later associated with, and the popes associated with the Holy Roman Empire, were never more than just influential. Islam had centuries worth of successful rule over entire states and nations, different successive empires, the Abbasid, the Umayyad, the Ottomans, the Mughals, very successful political rule over huge areas for long periods of time. And so as a result of that, you get these hardliners who think that Islam cannot really properly exist unless it is politically as well as, you know, demographically dominant. And that's
mm-hmm.
that's unfortunately very, very difficult, because most educated Muslims, of course, realize that they can exist along with all other religions at the same time in a democratic society. But the hardliners mm-hmm. think it has to be rule, that it has to have political dominance in order for it to really exist.
Mm-hmm.
Those are probably the two main underlying problematic things, to say nothing of all the stuff happening in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So
there's a lot of information out there about this Armageddon that is supposed to happen. Can you address that and how it relates to fundamentalism?
Well, Armageddon, of course, for me, Armageddon is a children's story. There are certain basic notions that you find across the board in all the religions. You find them more in the West than the East. You can also find them in the East, but you have to look deeper in the scriptures to find them. But those
mm-hmm.
notions are God, devil, heaven, hell, grace, Messiah, salvation, day of judgment. Those are
mm-hmm.
across the board. Okay, so the
mm-hmm.
notion of Armageddon really is a sort of escapist idea that, well, life is difficult now, but I won't bother to improve my condition. I won't bother to try to change things socially. I'll just wait for God to take care of it at the end of time.
Mm-hmm.
There is a tendency to think that way. So that's all. These notions are very superficial ideas, but there's
mm-hmm.
great depth behind each one. I mean, what is heaven really? What is the day of judgment really? Those things have metaphorical meanings. Okay. So
mm-hmm.
those are easy psychological answers for people who don't want to think about these notions. So, Armageddon, the real Armageddon happens inside us all the time. right? Armageddon, mm-hmm. Muslim Jihad, same idea. The struggle against negative tendencies, the constant effort to witness our thoughts, to understand and embrace the deeper aspect of our being, to love all aspects of ourselves at the same time, and to transmute those inner negative energies into more positive energy, which takes us to higher realms of reality. That is the real object of Armageddon, as I understand it, metaphorically. But, you know, psychologically and literally in religious history, it's just one more superficial idea meant to answer common questions for most folks in these religions who don't think beyond very superficial notions. And we need to start understanding these things more deeply than they're given to us in Sunday school. Yeah.
All right. Now, there is a psychological basis for fundamentalism,
right,
that is active because of, I'm better than you philosophy. I think you said in an earlier interview it was like a junior high type philosophy.
Chosen people, mm-hmm. only son of God, seal of the prophets. They all think
right. They're
the best. And fundamentalism is very interesting. You know, as children, when we grow up, usually in our early to mid-teens or sometimes before that, we always have the need at some point to belong to a special group, a certain mm-hmm. clique of friends, which is
right.
better than all the other cliques of friends out there. So some people never outgrow that. It's just deeper in their mind. So that when they do find their group, that is, when they walk into the right church and get saved or whatever, the right mosque or synagogue or what have you, they do have this profound experience because that's how deep it is in their case. I mean, you know, part of growing up is realizing that we're not special or unique in the way that we thought we were. Mm-hmm. Young boys are kings and young girls are princesses, because when you discover yourself for the first time, it seems like you're unique, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, fundamentalist believers merely experience the same thing at a deeper level. And sure enough, just like young people, they can only understand things literally.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think fundamentalism is really, and again, I don't apologize for passing judgment. We need to call a spade a spade. Fundamentalist religion is really hurting us planetarily and individually. Mm-hmm. We need to understand. I think it's better understood psychodynamically than spiritually. Get all these folks into the right kind of therapy for long enough, and we could fix them and all get along. You know, so I am struggling to embrace fundamentalists in my understanding of the human condition. As you can see, I have my attachments and issues with them, but I'm struggling mm-hmm. doing my best to embrace them, and I think that's a good way to start to understand what's really going on with these unfortunate interpretations of these monster religions.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a normal phase of growth. And
let's
ahead.
Let's talk about, you know, what happens later in the spiritual journey that we have over multiple lifetimes.
Right.
I mean, eventually we come back here often enough and learn the lessons that we're supposed to learn in kindergarten and treat other people as we would want to be treated, and, you know, just the basic stuff.
Yeah.
And then eventually we start on a course of exploration, trying to understand who we are. You know, that you start there.
Yeah.
And, eventually you end up understanding that, you know, the spiritual journey is one that you take not in a church, but one that, not that you can't go to church, but, you know, you have to learn to have this relationship that God is within, and you meditate and you end up, you know, studying different not religious, but more spiritual texts.
Yes.
You know, read the works of masters, read the works of across religions. You know, one religion doesn't have all the answers anymore.
Right, exactly.
You know, I read the Bhagavad Gita when I was in high school, you know, and I'm sure you
Bhagavad
did too.
Bhagavad Gita, sure.
That's right. So we start on a spiritual journey where we understand that, you know, the answers are within. And so we have to have that understanding. We're not going to get, you know, we're not going to have some religious authority tell us everything
yeah.
and dictate to us what our behaviors and our beliefs need to be.
Yeah, and again, I think that's where insight into the nature of these monster religions, especially Christianity, comes into play. You know, there is this, one of the reasons that Christianity is so successful is that, well, it's easy to relate to, believe in one God who is outside you. You can relate to him more easily. He's a parent. Mm-hmm. He's a friend. He's a business partner, you know.
Right.
And in all fairness, all religions do that, but especially in Christianity, it's easy to think of God as a friend. But he's really, not only is he inside you, he is you, you know, and it's very easy to lose sight of that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. One of the things that, you know, Christianity is thought by some scholars to have the best myth or the best, the most readily understood subconscious transformational dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Some thinkers like C.S. Lewis, great Christian apologist, he was a fundamentalist, basically, but he did, well, not he was a subtle fundamentalist, but he did have some profound insights. He said that Christianity is sort of scientific, even, in that it has the most effective mechanism. God became man so that man might become God. Very simple, but in terms of archetypes, extraordinarily effective. All religions utilize that idea in one way or another, but in Christianity, it's at the very core of the faith. Yeah, it's and we eventually realize that, you know, Jesus is us, that we all, every one of us, has the same spiritual status in the eyes of God as does Christ himself, as far as I'm concerned. One person may sell insurance, one person may, you know, empty garbage, one person turns water into wine. But we all have that same inner potential, and we all, you know, the only difference between myself fully realized and Jesus fully realized is that Jesus had the more noteworthy external karma. You know, he did more stuff. He was more noticed than I would be. But I think it's all the same in the end for everybody. Yeah.
So let's talk about the alternative to having the idea of one God.
Right.
You know, we know a little bit about Roman and Greek mythology, where they had multiple gods. One thing that comes to mind is that the previous religions that would encompass multiple gods may have actually been gods that were extraterrestrial-based, and there were multiple gods, and so therefore the religion has multiple gods. But then when we kind of grew up a little bit,
right?
I think the first one God came from Egypt, didn't it? Wasn't that was an Egyptian king that brought in the idea of one God, I believe.
Well, in terms of the Bible, I mean, Abraham is the first of the Jewish patriarchs. At some point, in the evolution of our intellectual history on the planet, God said, the real heavyweight out there said, okay, they're ready to start understanding who I really am. And then he gave Abraham the monotheistic insight, you know.
Right.
And Abraham spread to everybody else, slowly but surely. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if who was that? It's very plausible to me that some of the very early Egyptian pharaohs were probably entirely realized beings.
Yeah, there was one, I think it was Atmet or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it was one god, one Egyptian king that actually introduced the idea, and it wasn't popular at all, believe me. He paid for that.
Yeah.
Because the people were making money and on the multiple gods, you know, there was quite an industry.
Yeah, I believe he came along sometime into it, not in the early period, but perhaps sometime in the middle period of the kings. I don't remember exactly when, but
yeah.
He wasn't in the very beginning. Yeah, he was a great soul, no question about it.
Yeah.
And absolutely right. But I think there is one thing that needs to be understood is that, you know, polytheism is inherent in the human need to relate to our natural environment. Whether extraterrestrial or not, we need to relate to the mountains, the streams, the fields.
Right.
And that is those things resonate with us, and we need to we hold them in reverence by creating myths and stories around them, you know, mm-hmm. which is all of indigenous faith, all of indigenous religion, and
right.
of course that's what these monster religions historically have been suppressing and destroying. And there needs to be a more feminine element incorporated back into them somehow,
right.
for the sake of the planet and for our sake. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Wow.
So basically, when Jesus came along, there's
right.
really a big difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament, just sticking with Christianity.
Right.
The Old Testament God was quite, you know, a different character than the New Testament God, and had a lot more qualities of maybe an extraterrestrial rather than a true God that was all loving, you know. So that was that's one of the things I think when I talk to fundamentalists, I point that out to them, that probably the Old Testament God was a Palladian God that was, you know, was quite protective of one group of people and helped them in battles against other groups of people. And like the Hindu gods help their people against other groups of people. You know, in other words, it seemed like the gods were choosing peoples and then trying to advance their status on Earth. Whereas, you know, Jesus introduced the God of you know, a loving God, one that wasn't trying to, you know, to win battles for his chosen people.
Right. Yeah, I think it is certainly at least plausible. Well, we know that ancient Jewish tribes all had their own idols, you know, before
right.
they became officially
yeah.
Jews. There was a tendency to still worship all of the old agricultural deities. So actually becoming mm-hmm. monotheistic was very difficult for them. So they all tended to keep worshiping their own idols. And some of those idols may well have been fashioned after some ancient extraterrestrial visitor. Who knows? But, there is the Old Testament God. Again, I think most profoundly, because of this transcendence above and beyond nature, above and beyond the earth, it's automatically kind of masculine and commanding and controlling. It's a profound tendency.
Well, most of them were masculine. I mean,
yeah.
when Noah was told to build the ark, it was a male voice that told him.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not very common that any of these gods were female.
Absolutely. And one a basic thing to understand about these fundamentally erroneous thing, but again, necessary for the easy understanding connected with fundamentalist faith and mm-hmm. Sunday school. You have to have it this way if kids are going to understand it. Is that,
yeah.
you know, there was the Old Testament, certain understanding. A New Testament, New Covenant came along after that, which
mm-hmm.
which supersedes the Old Testament. And then the third level, the Islamic revelation, is yet another New Testament, as it were, superseding the New and the Old Testament from the Bible, each
mm-hmm.
better than the last, supposedly, but in reality, mystically, all the same thing.
Right.
And all of the political stuff on the surface is meant to promote the idea, for the sake of people who can't understand otherwise, that ours is the best, and we have the right truth, and this is how you learn it. It's possible to teach young kids monotheism in a way which
mm-hmm.
is balanced, but you'd have to either, you know, split the deities in half, male and female deities separately, or
mm-hmm.
have one picture with an androgynous deity with both at the same time.
Yeah.
You really have to do that to reform monotheism in a way that it needs to be reformed, to incorporate the feminine, compassionate, loving, creative element, as well
mm-hmm.
as the domineering, spacious, you know, philosophically profound element of the masculine at the same time. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I think you're right.
One thing that's interesting, since there's no original sin in Islam and Judaism,
right?
Why do the Orthodox people in these religions end up condemning women?
Well, original sin is really a fascinating idea. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it in one sense, it's a very profound, useful idea in that it really communicates the notion of this profound, primordial separation from God.
Mm.
But of course, it's also complete nonsense at the same time. You know, there is this. I mean, Judaism and Islam don't have the notion of original sin, but that
mm.
makes little difference, really. There's still this basic assumption that you're this flawed creature, exiled down here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the deeper understanding of original sin in Christianity. So, you know, there is this profound separation. And original sin, of course, is connected in it all again. So there is this profound separation. God is masculine up above. The earth tends to be feminine underneath. And along with that, there is this carryover predisposition to regulate women's behavior and appearance and so forth. Because of that, again, all it does is it reinforces the notion that sexuality is bad. Everything connected with the earth tends to be, you know, secondary and impure and sinful and so forth. Yeah,
well, Michael Rice says that sin is an ancient archery term in ancient Aramaic, which means to miss the mark. So when Jesus talked about sin, what he was talking about is you make a mistake, you try again, and you get it right. You know, you try again. You try to correct your archery mistake.
Right.
So that's probably what Jesus was actually teaching. Now, the other thing that's interesting is Adam and Eve, which is what the whole thing comes back to, Eve eating the apple and everything.
Right.
It turns out that probably Adam and Eve, according to Urantia, were upgrades. And every so often, an upgrade is sent in, a genetic upgrade, and both the man and the woman have sex with as many people as they can in order to upgrade the entire planet's genetic status. And that's what Adam and Eve were supposed to be. In reality, that's what they were, evidently, according to Urantia. So that's a totally different picture. It's like, whoops.
Well,
isn't that interesting that genetic upgrades are sent in when they're ready?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, isn't that a fascinating... I mean,
it's
that
a fascinating
our creator
idea.
Gods... Literally, we have creator gods called the Elohim, okay?
Right.
The Elohim watch us, and then when we're ready, we get upgrades.
Right.
I think that's fascinating. It's almost like, you know, when your computer is running too slow, they send in, you know, this fix, this upgrade, so that it runs faster.
Yeah, I think also more... In terms of more orthodox and popular understanding, the thing to realize about, you know, the Adam and Eve story, again, is that it's meant to communicate a clear chain of command, as it were, from the man to the woman. And the woman, of course, is associated with sin and so on. And then she's thought of as not to be as smart and everything else.
Right.
And Adam and Eve... that story was definitely hijacked, but again, you would have to throw out the whole structure of Judeo-Christian thought and bring in somehow a more soft, feminine element at the same time. And it would be very difficult to do that in terms of, you know, iconography and pictures and children's books and so forth.
Right.
But you could. And I hope, if there is any decent disclosure coming up, as I desperately hope there is, and who knows how much truth there is to it. I don't have your kinds of experiences, but if there is any heavy-duty disclosure coming up, then there may be a better explanation for how, all these myths came into place. Absolutely.
I think more than anything, we're going to start to understand the history of Earth, where, you know, basically the human race was upgraded from Homo erectus to Homo sapien, because they were trying to get slaves to mine gold. And that's basically what happened. I mean, that's, you know, in other words, the Anunnaki and Homo erectus DNA were put together to give us Homo sapiens, but the purpose of it was slave labor for gold, because the Anunnaki had said that, because, well, they lived a very long lifetime, too, and they didn't want to work in the gold mines because it wasn't very pleasant.
I do not have your level of familiarity with these theories, but I do hope that
there's a whole bunch of proof of that one, by the way. It's not just Zachariah Sitchin saying so. There's a huge amount of actual physical proof, from the cuneiform tablets to, I mean, that I've interviewed so many people with so much evidence that was true. That it's just really neat. Michael Telligence, evidence of all the gold mines. And I think that will come out. And when it does, we'll realize that the history of the earth is very, very different than what the Bible says. You know, it's very different.
I certainly hope that that's true, and I certainly hope that enough evidence can be mustered quickly enough to begin to make a real difference.
Yeah.
I want very much to believe, Randy Kramer's interesting statements and material that is so fascinating mm-hmm. and fun to listen to. I certainly hope that he hasn't just been watching too many movies. but, I mean, my own experiences being what they are, the nature of my own spiritual path being relatively, mm-hmm. when it comes to dreams and visions, relatively normal and humdrum, I will say that after Carl Sagan, that who was only an empiricist, I'm certainly not a fan of Carl Sagan's anymore, but mm-hmm. he did say, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
That's right.
So we do need more evidence, more pictures,
right?
More.
Well, I'll tell you what I think the problem is. Let me just say this: the problem is that most people do not have the sensory awareness that allows them to understand multidimensional reality.
Yeah,
you have to develop through years of meditation, through spiritual practices, to really get to the point where you can know that we live in a multidimensional reality. The creator gods, for example, are not in the third dimension, okay?
Right.
They're just not, okay?
Right.
God himself is not in the third dimension, okay?
And that
period.
Is what's so valuable about
you can't
about
go
dreams.
Meet God, you know, in a particular time-space location.
Yeah, and
that's the problem. You've got to evolve spiritually in order to understand this. You can't take it on faith. I mean, you can't say, well, I'm going to tell you my experience, and you just have to believe me.
Right.
That doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to have to experience yourself.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, again, the most available way to do that for most people is through their dreams.
Right,
The more that you can begin to dialogue with your dreams and to understand what they're telling you. And you don't need to understand symbolism. What you do need is a really profound desire to figure out, you know, what you're being told, and the fact that you can, through regular effort, dialoguing, writing them down, trying to figure them mm-hmm. out, writing down your questions in your diary, praying every night, you can tune into a more profound dimension, a profound understanding of reality through dreams.
Yeah, and I want to mention, we did a great interview on dreams not too long ago that's on the archives. So David gives a real good way to do this on that interview. So,
you do begin to have experiences. If you really develop your dream life and do other basic spiritual practices around that, you will begin to be guided in a way that you weren't before.
Right.
And you will begin to tune into a more profound experience of mm-hmm. synchronicity that happens to you every day.
Yeah.
And that leads you to greater understanding of everything. Yeah.
Yeah, when you really understand how connected everything is, then you really get that this is all basically here for your spiritual advancement.
That's right. And again,
all of that is, I mean, everything,
that process,
every person you meet, every TV show you decide to watch, I mean, everything fits together perfectly.
Yeah, and the first part of that process for a great many people is understanding the deeper aspects of these monster religions
mm-hmm.
and realizing that the reason they're bigger than all the other religions is because of this, you know, it is a universal across the board psychologically in all the religions at one point or another to think that your faith is the best. But there are a lot of reasons why that tendency is more prevalent in the Western than it is in the Eastern religions. And, you know, there's this ancient tendency to psychologically identify with this one God. You're great. You have this great egoic identification, and your ego's agenda identification with this one God. And therefore, you know, the main dynamic is, you know, if you think you have the only truth, in order to mm-hmm. convince yourself of that, and if you think you have the truth but you're not totally sure, in order to keep convincing yourself that you do have the highest truth, you'll go out and try to conquer and convince everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going on. That's the story of history right there.
It is.
Psychologically.
It is, absolutely.
And insight is being, being able to recognize that in yourself and understand the profound dimensions of how, you know, there's a masculine aspect and there's a feminine aspect, and understanding how that transcendence above the earth predisposes everybody in these religions to think in a masculine manner and suppress, you know, half the population and two-thirds of the great philosophy and all these wonderful practices which would have, you know, which would have helped us
save the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
really.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no kidding.
Then people can start. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I just, go ahead and finish, because I have a final question I want to ask, but go ahead and finish your thought here.
No, that's the main thing that I wanted to say about the monster religions. There are other things that which can be. I'll probably say something else in response to your final question.
Okay, well, what I want to talk about is what so many people have questions about, and that's the ascension. Now, Jesus said that the wheat will be separated from the chaff during this time period. And he thought the ascension was going to be 2,000 years ago. And he basically made that mistake. He thought that things were much more in his time, and they weren't. I mean, they're happening right now. So what is it going to look like? And again, I think we talked about this before. The ascension is the reversal of the Luciferian rebellion, which happened 200,000 years ago and put a whole bunch of restrictions on this planet, including when you come in, you forget you're connected to spirit, you forget all your past lives, you forget who you are. And then, of course, we have genocide, we have all sorts of, you know, raping the planet, we have everything, greed, everything, because we forgot who we were. But that's going to be removed, so... What I want to know is what are religions going to look like after the ascension?
Well, first of all, let me say that I don't think Jesus made a mistake about the ascension. The church fathers who put the gospels together and edited them into their final form made him say that. He didn't say that.
Okay.
Certainly not in that way. The ascension, of course, is it is internally the freeing of the spirit and the integration of the mind-body complex into a single profound understanding of reality in self-realization.
Multidimensional
That's the real
reality,
ascension.
By the way. Yeah.
That is the real ascension, right? So, I mean, again, what will religions look like after the ascension? Well, that's, you know, when Jesus comes back, metaphorically, Jesus returning is, you know, it can be initiation, it can be grace, higher initiation, or, you know, the advent of heaven on earth.
Right.
Or,
well, that's what he said. Brotherhood. Right, brotherhood, heaven on earth.
Right. So Jesus is not going to come back in fire and lightning, tooting horns from the sky with his 12 lamps and all the rest.
Going to war. Yeah, right.
It's a children's story. Come on. Yeah, I mean... Have I halfway answered your question? I forgot what it was even.
Oh, it's basically what will these religions morph into? That's a better way to put it. What are these religions going to morph into with the ascension? I mean, when each person is more in the multidimensional understanding of reality.
Right.
When, I mean, do you believe the religions are going to, like, end? Like, the Catholic Church will just end? Or do you believe that they will morph into? I mean, already the Catholic Church is saying that the concept of extraterrestrials is totally consistent with everything we believe, you know.
Right.
They're trying to get there, you know. They're trying to they understand what's coming. The leaders of the Catholic Church do. So they're trying to backpedal a little bit to make themselves look more modern.
And I think what'll happen when enough people have enough higher consciousness to begin to influence political structures, it's all going to be grassroots. More and more people will understand this stuff, except for, I mean, the higher up you go in terms of political hierarchy, the less it'll be understood overall. And everybody else's conscious, you know, spiritual influence from underneath, as it were, will cause eventually enough people in these hierarchies will begin to have insight that you know, all this political structure, all this historical tradition connected with these ancient teaching institutions which teach literal versions, it's all wrong. You know, it's all wonderful tradition, but it has to go. I do think that you will see religion will be understood for what it is, which mm-hmm. is, a series of moral stories meant to be understood by as if necessary by children, which is what politicians mm-hmm. often yeah. count on. Now, I think, Donald Trump, the one thing he could do, which I think would actually get him more votes, would be to claim himself as a Messiah.
No,
the Messiah, messianic belief has a big political history. If you want to become politically powerful, you claim yourself to be a Messiah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these religions will basically, the historical moral stories will be recognized as children's stories, really.
Yeah.
And people will start to have more profound understanding of them. The hierarchies will become ceremonial and will become sort of, titulary and not have the authority that they used to have.
Well, one thing disclosure is going to do, it's going to introduce us to higher level civilizations that have actually gotten past the nuclear threat, have gotten past the population explosion threat and its inherent danger to the planet when that occurs, when you can't control your own population. Evidently, from what a lot of people evidently from what some of the advisors to our government have said, every planet goes through a similar danger period.
Sure.
When the nuclear weapon threat, where you
that's
can actually
Carl Sagan's
end up
still
blowing
theory.
Up the planet, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a threat of overpopulation with the inherent risk to the planet, of damaging things.
Right.
And other life forms, which we're in right now. So we will have more education available once disclosure occurs about how to get through these danger points in evolution.
Yeah, I think also that we'll understand the important part that these religions played in terms of, I think that they do help control people's morality, and they have given us good official morals and laws and mm-hmm. traditions and everything, but all those will be part of all those will be understood to have been our childhood, as it were,
Yeah.
We need structure. We need structure,
right.
And there will come a time when all that is understood just to be just like, it's like children's training, as it were.
Right. Yeah.
So, I certainly hope that there is evidence, that more evidence will be coming through down at the general public level for, extraterrestrial mm-hmm. visitation and so forth, and for disclosure related information. The sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it is. According to many of the sources that I've read, this is occurring now. They're doing it slowly so that they don't freak people out. But like I said, about a year ago, there was no life or water on Mars, and now there's water and there's plant life, and pretty soon there's going to be animal life, and then who knows? There's going to be people. It's just going to be a gradual disclosure of new discoveries, so to speak.
I am hoping with every fiber of my being and with every heartfelt beat of my heart that all that's true, and the sooner the better. So, but in the meantime, I will say with all the optimism in the world that I may be wrong, that I'll believe it when I see it, but I certainly hope that I see it sooner rather than later.
Well, we are still in danger of endangering the planet, obviously.
That's for sure.
Look at Fukushima. That's one of the most serious problems we have. And, of course, the mainstream media doesn't even mention it anymore. But it's still a significant problem until we can learn to clean up radiation, which we haven't quite mastered yet. So there are still some very, very serious environmental problems that we're... And then all the oil spills and everything, all the pollution.
Well, we need terraforming. We need terraforming more than anything.
Right.
These guys got to help us out with the atmosphere.
The
heck with medicine, that's great. But what's really necessary is atmospheric modification. That's the big thing as far as I'm concerned. If there are other beings, they absolutely exist. No question about that. the sooner they come along, the better. And
well, they're going to have a lot of technology that will help things. There's no question. And I believe that's part of disclosure, is getting help with some of these big problems that they do have answers to. So, and we just simply don't at this point. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yeah, David Lowe, david@worldspiritualbody.com is the email. My book, the book I wrote, Universal Spiritual Philosophy and Practice, David Lowe, L-O-W, no E, David Lowe, MSPhD.com is the website. Yeah.
And I do want to say that we did interview David on his book, and for people who are looking for a single source of information to start their spiritual journey with, I think his book's excellent. So I would encourage you to get it.
Great. All right. Well, it's been wonderful being on the show, and we'll do it again sometime soon.
We will. Thanks so much for joining us, David. This is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.